Good morning. Well, when I walked over to give the first talk, it was sunny, and now it's overcast. We had about 50 minutes of sun, and I was out in most of it. So, here you guys are on a Sunday morning, and you're taking some time from your 1 or 2 days a week when you can veg out to be here. That's kind of cool from my point of view, because if none of you came, I'd just be talking to the wall. So I like that. But we're so time-driven, aren't we, in our society? We're so time-driven. And when I was young, we were not that time-driven. What time was not, do I have enough time to do this? Does she have enough time to do this? How much time is this going to take? Why does this take so much time? How can I do it so it'll take less time? Time, right? Constrains us, makes us tight. And not helped by billable hours and billable quarter hours and billable minutes. Not helped, right? The promise, one of the promises of meditation practice, of Zen practice, is that we can step outside of time. That time is a construct. It's an important construct. But we can step out of time. Especially that's why we do our sitting regularly here or at home. And I encourage people to do retreats as much as possible, because a retreat is a long time to step out of time. And even if you can only do it for a moment during the retreat, there's some relief. There's some sense of connectedness and joy when we're not constrained by time. And I just led a 2-day retreat here a couple of weeks ago. And as in other retreats that I've led here over the years, a couple of people came to talk to me a lot of people talked to me about sort of non-ordinary experiences that they had when they stepped out of time. Woman was in the Founders Hall there. That's our other hall, where we have a picture of our founding teacher, Dainen Katagiri. And she said she was in there in the hall and just kind of walking through it during the walking meditation. And, his spirit appeared. he appeared. It was a dim image, but he appeared. And she said, when he appeared, there wasn't any time. There was just his spirit or whatever it was. She didn't know what it was. And another guy said to me on the second day, he said, he came up to see me and he was kind of distressed and he said, I left my body during this last meditation. And I left time because I left my body. I left time. And should I be worried? And I said, no, that's cool. That's cool. Having these times when we see a visual image, a sound, a spirit, we leave our body. That's a sense that our meditation is deepening. That's a sense that we're really not caught so much by before and after. Really, really here. And we're touched by what we can't see, by non-ordinary reality. And in Buddhism, we have all these bodhisattvas that we chant about, these beings who in most Buddhism they consider are out there, spirits out there. But we kind of consider them archetypes within here, within us. So here's one, for instance, Manjushri just above my head, Manjushri Bodhisattva. And he's in, regardless of what Zen temple you go to around the world, he's usually the guy up there. And I was talking to him about my, my last talk. He's the Bodhisattva of Wisdom. His archetypal force helps us settle in to just being and not being caught by time. So, but in Zen, we pass through these visual images, these sounds, these spirits, these leaving your body or whatever, so that we can be just settle into a deep kind of ordinary stillness that's right here, that's at the center of being. But those are good signs. Those are not something to get worried about. Those are good signs that, as long as you just don't develop a religion out of them, you got to be careful about developing a religion out of anything, because then we get attached to a set of beliefs. And that attachment to a set of beliefs hinders us. That's why Manjushri Bodhisattva, I'll talk about him in a minute, is helping us let go of beliefs. So we talk about the Buddha nature, the Buddha not mind, still mind that's right here. And we realize when we do this practice deeply that we're being gently held by what we're opening up to. We're being already held by what we're opening up to. It's already holding us. And we get lost within ourselves. We want something. We want some special experience. And we grab. And then when we do that, our gaze narrows so we can't see beyond the walls of our consciousness. We can't see. We can't open to big mind, Buddha mind. And when we try to move beyond the walls, we create new walls. So today I'm going to do some poems, and I'm going to start with James Wright, and then I'm going to do the Sufi poet Kabir, then I'm going to do a little bit of Rumi, the Sufi poet Rumi, and I'm going to end with a Spanish poet that I'm fond of. So James Wright. James Wright, who was a poet here in the Twin Cities. This poem's really in two parts. The first part. While I stood here in the open, lost in myself. So we get lost in ourselves, don't we? We get lost in ourselves. And when we're lost in ourselves, our gaze narrows. When I stood here in the open, lost in myself, I must have looked a long time down the corn rows, beyond grass, the small house, white walls, animals lumbering toward the barn. Then he pivots. I look down now. It has all changed. Whatever I lost, whatever I wept for, was a wild and gentle thing. The small dark eyes loving me in secret. It is here at the touch of my heart. So we long for something that we've lost. Most of us do. We don't know where it is, but we know that there's a sense of deep peace in here, that maybe we just experienced it just a little bit once, but we long for it. We long for it. This feeling of connectedness to each other that comes with this peace. Ramakrishna said that when a person weeps for Brahma, and we would say to experiencing the heart mind or the Buddha mind, that weeping, that longing propels us to search and discover that wild and gentle thing that James Wright talks about, beyond our small, needy selves. So this guy up here, Manjushri Bodhisattva, who most of you can't see, he sees through the imagined split between tomorrow, today, and yesterday, between self and other, which makes us feel isolated and cut off and alone. And he's usually riding on what? Anybody remember? Anybody see what he's riding on? She says a tiger or a lion. And that's because it takes courage to sit in meditation. And that's why in just about at every meditation hall, there he is, riding on the line. It takes, because stuff comes up in your meditation. Scary stuff. Stuff that throws you off balance. You think you'd be more on balance in meditation, but actually you're more off balance because you're riding the line. You're opening up to the kind of the cauldron within you. And it's not, it's misbehaving. It's cauldroning. So we sit with courage, just on top of the lion or the tiger. And that's why we have lots of retreat days here, a year. We have like 25 or 30, so people get a lot of experience sitting on the lion. And Manjushri usually has a sword in one hand. He doesn't in this one. This one he's just on the lion. But he usually has a sword in one hand and a scroll in the other hand. And the sword, he's helping us cut through all of this stuff that we get lost in. Stuff that we get lost in. Helping us cut through it with his sword, gently cutting through it. No, bloodlessly cutting through. The sword is so sharp that it bloodlessly cuts through. And then with his scroll, he's giving us some words of advice to help us. His scroll. And he's really young. He's supposed to be really young. This one is not really young, but he's supposed to be really young because when we let go of all this stuff, we become more youthful inside. Our body may be decaying, but we become really young inside. Really young. That's referred to as prajna, before wisdom. So I talked last week about a bumper sticker I saw, which is a Manjushri bumpy sticker. Don't believe what you think. That's Manjushri. Don't believe what you think. Our thoughts can help us. We need our thoughts, but we need to be careful about getting attached to any of our thoughts, so that we're not lost inside, not lost. So James Wright says, a wild and gentle thing. The small dark eyes loving me in secret. It is here at the touch of my hand. It's here at the touch of my hand. And Kabir says, he calls this wild and gentle thing the guest. The guest. Kabir says, the guest is inside you and also inside me. You know the sprout is hidden inside the seed. We are all struggling. None of us has gone far. Let your arrogance go and look inside. The blue sky opens out farther and farther. The daily sense of failure goes away. The damage I have done to myself fades. A million suns come forward with light when I sit firmly in that world. When we sit firmly in this world, we think we can't open enough to appreciate this blue sky. But a million suns come forward when we sit totally absorbed, just in our meditation, just in our listening. We long for, we search, and then we open up to what we already are, to what is. So here's Rumi now, the third one. Rumi. Rumi calls us an artist. So we've had the wild and gentle thing, the guest, and now the artist. Rumi, inside you there's an artist you don't know about. He's not interested in how things look different in moonlight. Always we're thinking later on we'll be authentic. Later on we'll pay attention to our most inmost request. Later on, when the moon is just right or when our life is just right. But right now, inside you, there's an artist you don't know about. He's not interested in how things look different in moonlight. Is what I say true? Say yes quickly. So writes wild and gentle thing, Kabir's guest, Rumi's artist, and we use the word Buddha mind or Buddha nature, but it's not as good as these other words, because they're just words that are, describe something that's wordless. But what about the connotations of those words? Wild and gentle thing. Wild. Can't be captured by our thinking. Can't be captured by any religion. By any strategies. By any comparing. By any culturation. By any trying to make better use of our time. We can make better and better and better use of our time. But will we? Does that help us settle into this wild and gentle thing? It's not savage. It's gentle. It's not wild savage. It's wild gentle. Before we divide things up, we're safe, because it's everything's here that we need. We're just open. Everything's here. Everything's always been here. Inside you, there's an artist you don't know about. He's not interested in how things look different in moonlight. Wild and gentle thing. Guest. A guest is someone we treat well. We're happy to be with. You guys have come and joined me this morning as my guests. I'm so happy to be with you. So happy to be with you in my house, which is not my house, just this house. I want to take care of this house to honor you guys as my guests. My pleasure to have you over. And when you leave, I'll prepare my house again. Prepare it for your imminent arrival, as you will return. Just preparing my house, taking care of my house, and then you return. The moment I really prepare, give myself to preparing, your return is imminent. It's already here, because you never left. Artists suggest the creative force inside us that wants to express and create, wants us to express and create. All of us have this, but it gets sublimated. It gets pushed down by all of this crud that's in our consciousness, by all of these feelings, by all of this to-ing and fro-ing and bettering and worsing and self-judgment and criticism, inner tyranny, all that stuff. But it's here. We all have this. Rumi again, inside you there's an artist you don't know about. He's not interested in how things look different in moonlight. Is what I say true? Say yes quickly, says Rumi. We don't have to wait until the next retreat. I was just talking about retreats a few minutes ago, and they were thinking, oh, I got to do a retreat, more retreats, then I'll get this. Then I'll settle down. You don't have to wait. We're always waiting for something else when we'll feel more calm. But the calmness is here at the center, right? Even though it may seem like there's a cyclone, the inner center of the cyclone, it's still, it's always still. We have what we're looking for, or better, it has us. It has us. Say yes quickly to this guest, to this artist, to this wild and gentle thing, or we'll miss it. We'll miss it. But if we miss it now, we can get it later, because it's not of time. So don't worry. It's always supporting you. Sometimes we long for, we cry for, we search for this reality, this stillness, this embeddedness in the world and life, and we don't open. We stay closed. Sometimes we might do a whole retreat and we'll stay open, we'll stay closed the whole time. And then we get discouraged. But this yearning, this aspiration keeps us practicing, so that whether we know this wild and gentle thing or not, our life can grow in orbits. This is Rilke. No, I'm doing Rilke. Our life can grow in orbits. Rilke. Can I live my life in growing orbits, which move out over the things of the world? Perhaps I can never achieve the last, but that will be my attempt. I'm circling around God, around the ancient tower, and I have been searching for 1,000 years, and I still don't know if I'm a falcon, or a storm, or a great song. Maybe we can't achieve this last orbit. Every morning I've been chanting here for 50 years, when here in San Francisco, 50 years, we chant the Heart Sutra, and it ends up unsurpassed, unexcelled, perfect enlightenment. Well, maybe that sounds pretty idealistic, doesn't it? Maybe I can never reach out to that orbit in this lifetime. But I can circle in growing orbits. We can all circle, even if we're in a narrow orbit, we can circle, which is opening. I can soar like a falcon. We can all soar like falcons. I can be with the storms that pass through my consciousness, through my being, with my Manjushri Bodhisattva calmness, just being. And I can sing, sing, sing. I'm circling around God, around the ancient tower, and I have been circling for 1,000 years. And I still don't know if I'm a falcon or a storm or a great song. We can sing our heart out. The yearning, the questing is transformed when we sing our heart out. We open up to the Buddha nature. We open up to that wild and gentle thing when we sing our heart out. And then we welcome and we appreciate all of these guests that come into our lives, even the obstreperous ones, the ones that don't want to go home, that eat all our hors d'oeuvres and drink all our whiskey. We may not invite those particular guests back for a while, but it doesn't mean we don't love them and appreciate them. We're not fools, right? Next time we invite those guests back, we'll lock the liquor cabinet. Right, it's wild and gentle thing. Kabir's guest that is inside us. Rumi's artist. What we call, in a more pedestrian way, the Buddha mind. The Buddha mind. And in addition, in Zen, the Buddha mind is the everyday mind. So my teacher, my first teacher, Shinryu Suzuki, gave a series of talks years ago on the Buddha mind. And this last talk was on the Buddha mind is the everyday mind. And I talked about this a while ago. And he was talking, and he said, you everyday mind, Buddha mind. And he kept calling back and saying that, you everyday mind, Buddha mind. And I thought to myself, well, it's fine for him to say, but my everyday mind sure ain't the Buddha mind. My everyday mind is just waiting, wondering how long it's going to be before I can get out of here, get some relief in my legs, and see my girlfriend. All I'm doing is thinking about my girlfriend while he's talking about you everyday mind, the Buddha mind. That's not the Buddha mind. That can't be the Buddha mind. And then he looks at me, and I think he's looking right in my eyes. And he says, you everyday mind, Buddha mind. And I think, and I go, oh. And then I open up to that wild and gentle thing. Whoa. Just my screwed up mind. Just my mind that's just thinking about my girlfriend. That's the Buddha mind. There's nothing that's not it. There's nothing that's not it. The everyday mind is the Buddha mind. Ooh, amazed. I've been sitting for several years when that happens. I'm still amazed. that my it's my own screwed up mind. That's the same mind. But it's true. It's true. Oh, and then after that talk, that's a Sunday talk that he used to give, then I'm telling my friend who was sitting next to me, I said, you know, he looked at me, and he said, you, everyday mind, Buddha mind. And my friend said, no, he looked at me. He wasn't looking at you. And I felt the same thing you did. So then I talked to someone else. They said, no, he looked at me. Right? Competitiveness, right? Well, that's part of that Buddha mind, competitiveness, everyday mind. Don't worry. We're all competitive. Don't worry. Just be. Love the world as it is, without condoning the things you've done to hurt yourself or others. It doesn't mean condoning the things. It means just loving what is. The things we've done to the planet, it's embarrassing in front of the Buddha mind, isn't it? But we don't condone those, but we still love the planet as it is. Take care of it. Try to be a guest on this planet. So another poet, David Ignato, can I be content to look at a mountain for what it is and not as a comment on my life? Can you be content to look at a mountain or a lake or the building as what it is and not as a comment on your life? Always caught by the commentary over and over and over. Boring, isn't it boring? If you're not bored by it yet, do more retreats. Then you'll really know what it is, what it's like. Can I be content to look at a mountain just as a mountain? To look at you just as you rather than commenting on you? Rather than chattering to myself about Donald Trump or bad coffee during the last coffee hour? I'm just making that up. I don't even drink coffee, so... Or when the weather is going to be good. We had 32 minutes of sun this morning. I get my weather app out and see what's going on here. Or what does it mean for my life that I'm going to be 76 in less than a month? Gee, there's a lot of commentary that can go into that, right? Oh, I'm still co-guiding teacher here. Am I remembering stuff? What do I do about the numbness in my feet? I sit? How do I handle that? Should I? All kinds of comment. How long can I last doing this? et cetera, et cetera. Commentary about commentary upon commentary. Right? It's a human condition. It's not something to get wigged out about. The everyday mind is the Buddha mind. Right? But can I sometimes use Manjushri's sword just to cut through the commentary and come back to just being? Just being? Just being? Letting the commentary just do its thing, but not getting captured by it? Don't need to get captured by it. It wants to protect you. That's why it goes on and on with redundancy after redundancy after redundancy. That's okay. The everyday mind is the Buddha mind. So, instead of just me, can I live my life in growing orbits? That's what Rilke is asking us. That's what he's asking himself. That's his aspiration. And we can. That's our meditation practice. That's our Zen practice. We can. Tales of a Magic Monastery. I used to talk from this book. It's a book about Christian mysticism. I knew there were many interesting sites, but I didn't want any more of the little answers. I wanted the big answer. So I asked the guest master to show me to the house of the Christian God. I sat myself down, quite willing to wait for the big answer. I remained silent all day, far into the night. I looked him in the eye. I guess he was looking me in the eye. Late at night, I seemed to hear a voice. What are you leaving out? I looked around. I heard it again. What are you leaving out? Was it my imagination? Soon it was all around me, whispering, roaring. What are you leaving out? What are you leaving out? What are you leaving out? Was I cracking up? I managed to get to my feet and head for the door. I guess I wanted the comfort of a human face or a human voice. Nearby was the corridor where some of the monks live. I knocked on one cell. What do you want? What am I leaving out? Me, he answered. I went to the next door. What do you want? What am I leaving out? Me, the second guy said. A third cell, a fourth cell, all the same. I thought to myself, they're all stuck on themselves. I left the building in disgust. Just then the sun was coming up. I had never spoken to the sun before, but I heard myself pleading, what am I leaving out? The sun, too, answered, me. That finished me. I threw myself flat on the ground. Then the earth said, me. Not just accepting the world's peculiarities and your screwed-up mind, the strange deformities that come out of your screwed-up mind, in case you haven't noticed them yet. Not just accepting them, but loving them and singing their praises, because they're what is. They're what is. The everyday mind is the Buddha mind. The everyday mind. So I'm going to finish with a poem an excerpt from a poem by Pablo Neruda, which is more beautiful in Spanish than English, but I'm going to read it in English. Maru Mori bought me some socks, which she knitted herself with her sheep herder's hands, two socks as soft as rabbits. I slipped my feet into them, as into two cases knitted with threads of twilight and goatskin. My feet were honored in this way by these heavenly socks. They were so handsome. Beauty is twice beauty, and good is doubly good when it is a matter of two socks made of wool in winter. The everyday world is the Buddha world. So that's what I want to say, and be glad to take questions or comments from anyone about socks or something more esoteric. I know a lot about socks. And you do too, more than you realize. Questions, comments? Yeah, Jim.
So as you were talking about the conversations and the mind, well, the bumper sticker that comes to mind for me is, if you didn't change your mind, how would you know you had one?
That's a good one.
I guess it means to me that, you know, accepting your conversation and, being kind to it, I guess.
That's right. Good, yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So say that again. Say the bumper sticker slogan again.
If you didn't change your mind, how would you know you had one?
There's some freedom in this. There's some freedom in this, that our mind is always changing. Even if you think you're in a funk or in a dark place, everything's changing. So you can perpetuate that funk for as long as you need to, but it's going to change. It's going to change. And also, when you're in elation, you're going to be going down. Well, because that's the human situation. We live in orbits. We live in orbits. And if we can just be present with each orbit, sometimes the orbits contract, sometimes they expand. And that's human consciousness. That's human life. So we're pretty lucky. But we want to get out of these orbits and just have some absolute truth where nothing changes. The absolute truth is just the joy of being in the orbits. Just being in the orbits.
You know, a lot of people kind of separate out the commenting, criticizing mind
from
their true self.
That's right.
Label it the ego.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you view that?
Well, I both ways. Both ways. We have to get in touch and open up to our critical self-talk to be free from it. And if we just diss our critical self-talk, then our inner critic turns into an inner tyrant. So as much as possible, we're trying to notice the superfluity of all this commentary and critical self-talk without being judgmental of it. And knowing that it actually has some function from a Darwinian point of view in the survival of the human species, but we just overdo it so much. So it is part of our everyday mind, the commentary, but as long as we're just transfixed by it, we don't enjoy life, and because we don't feel this wild and gentle thing in here. We just, the inner critic is just commenting on it, you know, how we can have more of it, or whether it really exists, or something like that. So both the everyday mind is the Buddha mind, and the everyday mind is not the Buddha mind, because we get stuck on it. We're tight. We're not open. How's that? Okay. Other people. Always the men talk, never the women. Have you noticed that? We're acculturated to talk, us guys. To talk. I'm just making that comment. That's all. Anybody else? Oh, a woman. Carrie. You are a woman, aren't you?
So you used a lot of poets.
Yeah.
Yeah. The idea of the Buddha mind.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, when I go about my regular day, how I would love to immerse myself in poetry and, you know, be in nature.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Be with this more. But that's not my usual day.
That's right. That's not your usual day.
How can we take this, right, access this part of ourselves, and yet, you know, it comes, I'm just thinking, it comes back to the time thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're so pressed for time.
Yes.
You know, to take the time to like live the poetry.
Yes. Yes. You know? Well, of course, you can take a few phrases of poems that you really like and keep them in your pocket, or keep them on your desk, or keep them in your classroom, and use them throughout the day. So many people have talked, I've talked many times about little phrases that I used to use. I kept a phrase on my refrigerator. I kept a phrase on my alarm clock, especially when I was having trouble getting up in the morning. I didn't do that at work, but it would have been good if I had. I kept little phrases from my teacher or from poets that reminded me that I needed to come back to just being with what was, and that there's stillness right in the middle of this cyclone. So we can use those. Those don't take any time. Well, it'll take a little time to find one and then put them on your desk, or put them in your pocket, or put them on your iPhone, you know, and beep your iPhone every hour, and the phrase pops up. You can do that with your iPhone now. You have it beep every hour, and there it is. The wild and gentle thing pops up if that's what moves you. And then you can also during the day there's a practice that I taught when I taught mindfulness at work of three breaths. So every time you're in between something, you're going to go to the bathroom, or your kids have left the classroom, or you're moving to a meeting, you can take three breaths, and you can put your hands on the desk when you take the three breaths, or your hands on, and you can do that throughout the day. So it's not, but I think since work is such a big part of our lives, it takes some strategy. Instead of all this superfluous inner commentary, why don't we use our mind strategically to do some things during the day, whether it's reminding us about breathing or our favorite teachers or poets to bring us back.
Yeah, it just is so sad to me that...
Pardon?
It's so sad to me that those things that do bring us back are not the things that are driving our society.
They're right. They're not the things that are driving our society.
Yes. Is there a computer code that's going to make us...
Yes. 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 It's sad. It's sad. But, you know, there is a wave, and also there's a counter wave. The counter wave may be small culturally, but when I was young and doing meditation, nobody was interested in meditation. It was considered really weird. Everybody thought it was really weird. Now there's a counter wave. The reason we're having to do two Sunday talks now is because of this counter wave. Because now meditation is socially acceptable. I've said many times, I wish I could bring my dad back to life. I wish I could get his spirit back to life so he'd see that I wasn't just doing some fringe thing. So we have so much need now that meditation has entered the mainstream. And look at how yoga is in the mainstream and how people really need their yoga and use their yoga. So this is a complementary wave. I know it's a small one, but it does give me some hope